You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss.
Step by step along this march, can be won, many stones can form an arch, singly done.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions and is sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at UMKC. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved.
And welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. My name is Jen Zaman, and I am taking over tonight for the vacationing Judy Ansel, who's on assignment. And so tonight, we are being underwritten by Teamsters, United Auto Workers, Local 249 members building the best Ford trucks and vans in the world, and by Teamsters Joint Council 56. Teamsters Joint Council 56 and our nine local unions represent 30,000 workers, retirees, and their families in Western Missouri, Kansas, and Nebraska. We are proud to support the Heartland Labor Forum and their commitment to give working families a voice in the greater Kansas City community. And we thank our underwriters for their support to the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI. Welcome to tonight's show. With a socialist running for president as a Democrat, we thought we would look at socialists from the past who ran. Join us for a trip back to the first part of the 20th century and the campaigns of Eugene Debs and Norman Thomas. How did they do? Are there lessons for Bernie? And then, teacher tenure is under attack. We ask what happens to academic freedom when teachers are stripped of job security. In the news, nurses at Menorah Hospital are fed up with stalled negotiations. Our feature at the end of the show is Safety First with Mary Aereo. And now, the news.
This is the news from our site, August 6, 2015. On Friday, July 30th, members of the National Nurses United held a picket of about 50 nurses in front of Menorah Medical Center in Johnson County, Kansas. Judy Ansel was there and interviewed a nurse.
Tell me your name.
I'm Summer Baker. I'm a nurse here at Menorah. I've been a nurse for 8 years. I work in several of the critical care units here at Menorah, including the intensive care unit and the emergency room. We're out here today because we want Menorah to comply better with its own staffing plan to give us the amount of nurses that we need on each unit based on how many patients are there at that time. We want to be able to take our meal breaks and know that there is someone there to cover for us, to watch our patients. We are asking that Menorah lead the way in wages and help us to get up to the national average.
How much below the national average are you in wages right now?
Kansas is ranked 45th in the nation with wages.
And you mentioned your lunch breaks. Do you often skip your lunch breaks because there aren't any nurses to cover for you?
When we miss lunch breaks, it is because we do not have nurses to cover for us to safely care for our patients. On the general surgery recovery floor, nurses in a three-month period miss their lunches a third of the time in those 3 months.
Is there a lot of turnover here as a result of these poor working conditions?
We're requesting that the wages be brought up closer to the national average to help with retention and recruitment here at Menorah.
Let me ask you one other thing. How long have negotiations been going on?
We started negotiations in March. Our contract expired in May.
So you're working without a contract?
There are protections within the contract, but our contract expired in May.
Okay, so is this the first time you've had a demonstration here? In this round of negotiations?
Yes.
Is it possible you guys are going to go on strike?
It's our right, and we just might.
Okay, thanks.
Mm-hmm.
We want wages! And Dr. Donald L. Rasmussen, who initiated a grassroots movement that won benefits for coal miners afflicted with black lung disease, died July 23rd in Beckley, West Virginia. In the annals of American labor history, there is no one, no union official or physician who exceeds the accomplishments of Dr. Rasmussen in substantially reducing the causes of such a widespread and deadly disease as black lung, or in enhancing the treatment of a group of afflicted workers. And that was reported by James Green, Professor Emeritus of History at the University of Massachusetts, Boston, and he told that to the New York Times. The advent of X-rays established that black lung disease was caused by breathing coal dust particles from drilling and blasting, but Dr. Rasmussen proved that even when X-rays did not find evidence of black lung, the disease could also be detected by breathlessness measured while on a treadmill and by blood test, vastly expanding the pool of miners eligible for benefits. Without Dr. Rasmussen's work, the quality of life for thousands of miners would have been destroyed, and their families would have gone uncompensated. Richard Trumka, the president of the AFL-CIO and a former president of the United Mine Workers, reported that on Friday. When other doctors were taking the company line and denying that black lung existed, Dr. Rasmussen was testifying before state legislators and Congress, fighting to win recognition that breathing coal dust was killing miners. Cecil E. Roberts, the United Mine Workers president, reported that last week. And coal dust and methane explosion killed 78 miners on November 20th, 1968, and that was in Marion County, West Virginia. It drew national attention to the issue and inspired a strike that prompted both state legislation and the 1969 Federal Coal Mine Health and Safety Act, which provided compensation for workers permanently disabled by black lung disease and imposed dust limits in coal mines. That year, the American Public Health Association presented Dr. Rasmussen with its presidential award. And Dr. Rasmussen's commitment to the pulmonary health of West Virginia's miners spanned 7 decades until his deteriorating health forced him to retire this past May.
Verizon Wireless has released a phone application that will enable non-unionized employees to record workers on strike. The application, which has features that will only be enabled in the case of a strike, is being promoted by the communications giant as a means of ensuring that the kinds of harassment they allege occurred during a 2011 strike won't happen again this round of contract negotiations. The CWA was quick to respond to the application's release, and naturally they were quite critical of Verizon's intentions. Verizon makes $1 billion in profit every month while they are asking their employees to pay thousands more for their health care and shipping good family-supporting jobs overseas. Bob Master, political and legislative director of Communication Workers of America District 1, told The Verge in a statement. So it's no surprise that they are intimidating workers by encouraging managers to take photos of union members as they are lawfully picketing and protesting.
And tonight is the first Republican presidential debate, and Matt Taibbi, over at the Rolling Stone, has provided the rules for a drinking game to help make the spectacle a bit more tolerable. So get your glasses ready. Drink the first time when Donald Trump mentions his wealth or how smart he is. Number two, a candidate mentions Benghazi. Number three, a candidate says this president. Number four, a candidate whines about not getting called on enough. Number five, someone promises to take America back. Number six, Trump interrupts someone by saying, excuse me, let me answer that. Number seven, anyone mentions Hitler, Nazis, or Neville Chamberlain includes related imagery like the ovens. Number eight, the crowd cheers a racist, bigoted statement by a candidate. Number nine, a candidate mentions his poor, hard scrapple upbringing, or a parent who worked every day of his life. Number 10, a candidate talks about stopping Hillary Clinton. 11, anyone warns the U.S. is becoming Greece. 12, Trump refers to himself in the third person. 13, anyone invokes St. Ronald Reagan.
Drink every time a candidate claims a positive relationship with a minority, also known as the some of my friends are rule. A candidate tries to speak Spanish, tries to warm up to the Ohio crowd with an awkward LeBron shout-out. Drink every time you hear the words, I am not a scientist, you can keep your doctor, Acorn, the war on Christians, Thug, right in here in Ohio, culture of dependency. Take a shot of Hager at the mention of Kenya or All Lives Matter.
I think with that lot, I think the rest of us would be completely hammered by like just maybe the first five. Anyway, I've got actually one last good and welfare news item. I want to give a shout out and congratulations to Chris Mann, Michael Savoir, Diane Krautheimer, Hester Dusick, and Angie Williams, all of the Heartland Labor Forum, for winning the ILCA Media Award contest. They got second place and third place at the contest. And the first one, the second place, was for Heartland Labor Forum's Ferguson Anytown USA, which was done, got second place in electronic media and long audio programs. And that was produced by Chris Mann. And the Postal Worker segment was by Diane Krauthammer. And the feature was by Angie Williams. Third place went to Labor Marchers for Civil Rights, and that was third place for electronic media and long audio programs, and that was produced by Michael Savoir, Chris Mann, and Hester Dusick. So huge, huge congratulations to all of those people. They're really important members of our crew here, and we support them 100%, so congrats. The news tonight was read by Molly Madden, Jake White, Ariana Eckel, Molly Madden, and Shaikel and Hams. And I am Jen Zaman.
We'll join our hands in union strong to battle or to die. Hold the fort, for we are coming. Union hearts beat strong. Side by side, we battle onward. Victory will come. My comrades, see the Union banners waving high. Reinforcements now appearing, victory is nigh. Hold the fort, for we are coming. Union hearts beat strong. Side by side we battle onward, victory will come. Our numbers still increasing, hear the bugle blow. By our union we shall triumph over every foe. Hold the fort, for we are coming. Union hearts beat strong. Side by side we battle onward, victory will come. Fierce and long the battle rages, but we will not fear. Help will come whenever it's needed. Cheer my comrades, cheer.
My name is Lon Swearingen, and we are going to be talking about socialism. But before we do, let me introduce you to our guest, Tim Kelly. Here's some background information. Tim Kelly is a member of the Eugene V. Debs Foundation and has served on the organization's board of directors and for a time was the foundation's secretary. He has also taught labor history for a number of trade union apprenticeships programs in Indiana. Mr. Kelly also spent more than 30 years in state government, where he served in a variety of field and administrative positions, including that of Deputy Commissioner of the Indiana Department of Workforce Development. Vermont's independent U.S. Senator and self-described Democratic Socialist Bernie Sanders has seen increasing success in the early months of the bid for the 2016 Democratic presidential nominations. His poll numbers are on the rise in the early primary states of New Hampshire and Iowa, and the campaign has raised more than $15 million coming in forms of small donations from about over a half a million individuals. Bernie is campaigning against income inequality in the country that leaves millions of Americans working longer hours for declining wages, while wealthy billionaires continues to a rapid rise. He argues freedom of speech is not freedom to buy U.S. government, and he advocates for a large investment in the nation's infrastructure, which could create as many as 13 million good-paying jobs. He points to the ever-increasing threat of corporations controlling the daily political and economic life of the nation. These campaign issues are taken directly from the 2 days' headlines. However, we should recall that there are very similar to the political issues being debated and addressed 100 years ago, when another American socialist, Eugene Debs, was seeking the presidency. Debs was the standard bearer of the Socialist Party in five campaigns between 1900 and 1920. Norman Thomas followed Debs in the party's leadership, running for president in six campaigns between 1928 and 1948. Debs and Thomas were important figures in the socialist movement in the first half of the 20th century and were important forerunners of Sanders' campaign today. Before going further, we should more clearly define democratic socialism. Would you do that, Tim?
Yeah, it's a democratic political system. It functions alongside a socialist economic system. When we think of socialism, sometimes people refer to the Soviet Union. It was, but it's an authoritarian model, and that's rejected by democratic socialists. It's probably best seen when you look at the United Kingdom and the Labour Party, when you look at Scandinavian countries and the political structure and the systems that they've put in place. It's also been successful in France, India, Canada, and of course the current president of France is a socialist. It's also, socialism's not foreign to America, as some people would argue. In the early 19th century, there were a number of religious communities that were set up on a communal basis for the common good of the group. And also, in a more secular community, New Harmony, Robert Owen, the same. It was in a socialist atmosphere and structure. You also have had Thomas Skidmore, a New York member of the Working Men's Party in 1829, wrote a book, The Rights of Man to Property, in which he demanded a fair distribution of wealth. And this was 20 years before Karl Marx, even. So you have this variety of history related to socialism in America. In the 19th and 20th century, late 19th, early 20th century, you even had unions that were developing their own cooperatives. And you also had unions that were advocating for socialism as a principle.
Tim, would you give us some background information on Eugene Debs and specifically how he became a socialist?
Debs was born in Terre Haute, Indiana in 1855. He was the son of immigrants. His parents were Alsatians who left France in the 1840s. Growing up, his hero was John Brown. He was very much an abolitionist as a young man, and so John Brown remained one of his heroes. Later, he left school at a young age to go to work as a painter in the rail yards. While working there, he managed to work his way into another job, that of a locomotive fireman. He became a charter member of the BLF, or the Brotherhood of Locomotive Firemen, in 1875 in Terre Haute, and worked the rails as a railroad worker, locomotive fireman. He was forced by his mother to leave. She was terrified of the fact that he might be killed. And he left for a brief time, worked as a bookkeeper, became city clerk of the Terre Haute, Indiana, on two terms as a Democrat. and served one term in the Indiana legislature as a Democrat. He became very disenchanted with politics and the Indiana legislature in particular because he saw his bills trying to promote railroad safety just demolished by the Republicans of the time, and he was unable to get anything valuable as far as he was concerned through the Indiana legislature. So he turned his focus back to trade unionism. He had continued his connections with the BLF and soon ended up as the secretary treasurer of the national organization, and he was editor of the magazine. So he continued in a role of, as a trade unionist until we get into the late 1880s when he became discouraged again and that the craft unions weren't really protecting the workers. And he started to think that maybe the best approach might be an industrial union. Eventually, 1893, he helps found the American Railway Union, which takes in all workers, regardless of craft. And it's launched in a very successful campaign that includes winning the Great Northern Railroad Strike of 1893. His victory there alarmed the railroads. And the next spring, he was asked by the Pullman employees in Pullman town, which is just south of Chicago, to help when they struck. The American Railway Union allowed them to join, and there was a national railroad strike from that. The problem with it was that the railroads were ready. They were ready to retaliate, and in a massive response, coordinated with the U.S. government, they crushed the strike. They brought in strike breakers. They brought in they deputized thugs as deputy U.S. marshals, and they also brought in the government, the president, Cleveland, ordered in federal troops. That resulting crushing defeat really angered Debs. He was actually jailed for 6 months for violating the injunction, and during that time he determined that society in America would not get anywhere unless the workers could get a fair break, and he decided that capitalism would not provide that avenue, and from that he declared himself to be a socialist.
All right. There is also the idea that Norman Thomas, how did he become involved in the Socialist Party, and what influences did he have?
Norman Thomas, as a young man living in Marion, Ohio, worked for Warren Harding. He was a paper boy. His father was a Presbyterian minister, and he had an interest in the ministry. He would later go off to Princeton. He got a degree from Princeton. And as a minister, the Presbyterian Church became very concerned about what's happening in the country. He was very much an anti-war person. He was very supportive of what he defined as Christian socialism, that socialism, in his definition, would be that of applying the principles of Christ on earth. And so he took up that cause. He went to the Socialist Party just as that, as a Christian socialist with not an interest in Marxist socialism. He also viewed it as more of a pragmatic rather than dogmatic approach. He was selected to run for U.S. Senate, for governor, and for mayor of New York City. Did very well in his vote totals, and was kind of a rising star in the Socialist Party. During his years at Princeton, he also had connections with Woodrow Wilson, who was his instructor. So it's kind of an unusual man. And in that case, Norman Thomas was one of those people you'd want to know in the six separations as far as that link to all these noted people. Thomas was sort of in the right place at the right time when Debs died. The two leaders at the time in 1926 when Debs passed away were Morris Hillquit and Victor Berger, who was actually in Congress. Both men, unfortunately, were foreign-born and didn't qualify to run for president. With the positive benefits that he had provided to the party, he was more or less next in line and was nominated in 1928 then to run for president first time. He would eventually run six times.
Okay. Now, in the Socialist Party platform, what planks were most significant, and were any of them adopted in America?
Well, there were quite a few. The Socialist Party had adopted a variety of planks, some very familiar from the populist side of the House, but some very unique to the party, to the Socialist Party. They advocated the collective ownership and democratic management of railroads, wire, wireless telegraph, telephones, express services, steamboat lines, and basically anything related to transportation, and also any large-scale industry. They called for collective ownership of banking and the currency. They declared the need for unemployment insurance, employment bureaus where there was no fee involved, and they also advocated for funds for public works to get the unemployed back to work, but also to improve the infrastructure. They also called for an old age pension system, which today we have Social Security. You mentioned as far as things being adopted, obviously we do have an unemployment insurance system today. And they called for the elimination of child labor. Those laws were adopted not that many years after they called for that. This is actually a 1912 platform, but it's very, very common as far as what they were advocating. And they also called for establishing a minimum wage. Like some of the other parties, too, they called for the popular election of U.S. senators and the votes for women.
Right. Now, would you compare Bernie Sanders and his road to the presidential politics and that of Eugene Debs?
There are similarities. Both men were the sons of immigrants. As I mentioned previously, Gene Debs' parents immigrated from France, from Alsace. Bernie Sanders' father immigrated from Poland as a 17-year-old during the Second World War. In fact, as a Jewish man was forced to leave and lost a good part of his family to the Holocaust. So in that case, both Debs and Sanders being sons of immigrants, they both had humble beginnings. Debs' mother actually had to open a grocery store in the front room of her house to keep from the family from starving when her husband was very ill. Bernie Sanders grew up in a working-class neighborhood in Brooklyn. His father was a salesman of paint. So again, kind of humble beginnings, and both men having a good understanding of what it's like to not have money in the bank. They both have similar political backgrounds, and they both began their political careers in local government. Bernie Sanders was elected three terms as mayor of Burlington, Vermont. Debs, two terms as the city clerk of Terre Haute, Indiana. They both went on to experiment with third parties. Debs initially was a Democrat and converted to third party activity. Bernie Sanders ran all of his races as an independent, or even early on in the Liberty Union Party, but now converting to at least the Democrat Party for this particular run. So again, some similarities in their races. Bernie was in Congress. Debs ran for Congress at one time. Debs running for president five times as a socialist, and Bernie running as a Democrat, but with the Democratic Socialist principles.
All right. How come the Socialist Party didn't really resonate? And was there a period that they came close before in the early 20th century or later?
The party never succeeded in getting the huge votes that they hoped for. When they first ran, they got less than 100,000 votes in 1900. Their high water year, high water mark, was 1912, when they got 6% of the vote, with it just short of a million. In 1920, Debs ran from prison, having been jailed for his opposition to World War I. In that year, he got nearly a million votes, which is pretty remarkable for somebody running from a jail cell in Atlanta Penitentiary. But those were the closest they had. When Debs was running for office, there are a couple points I would make. 1912, he actually received more votes than Teddy Roosevelt or Taft in a number of southern states. And he had 16% of the vote in Oklahoma. And nationwide, there was in the neighborhood of 1,500 local officials elected, many mayors, city council people, number of people elected to the legislature. So the party had some successes. But I think what you can say is their biggest success would be their what they offered in those platforms. By 1932, with the election of Franklin Roosevelt and the implementation in the 30s then of the New Deal, we get unemployment insurance, we get Social Security, we get guarantees of unions to be able to organize. And with that, many of those points advocating the socialist platforms were being adopted across the country.
Just curiosity, what do you think of Bernie Sanders' chances?
No one really believed when they were discussing the possibility of Bernie Sanders running for president that he would do what he's done already. The fact that he's 37% or better in the polls. Obviously, he's behind in terms of Hillary Clinton. But he's gaining. The fact that he has this groundswell of grassroots support is surprising to a lot of people at this early stage. I can recall a number of years ago, and I've heard him compared to, well, it's just another situation like McGovern. Well, at this point with George McGovern, he had 3% of the vote, not 37%. So right. I think looking at that, I think there's a real strong he's going to make this a competitive race.
So let's conclude with this. Thomas chose not to seek the presidency again after 1948. Poor showings in 1952 and in 1956 led the party to discontinue the nominations of national tickets in later years. Several attempts in the 1970s and 80s to revive the party have not taken root. Why is it 2015? Is Bernie Sanders creating such an interest? One, the huge income inequality in the America, which has reached levels not seen since the 1920s. More than 30 years of decline in household incomes, labor movement in decline as right-to-work laws enact in Indiana and Michigan, and public employee unions under direct attack from many Republican governors. Decline in the labor movement translates into a decline in the standard of living for the middle class. Today's challenges are much the same as found in the time of Debs. The names are no longer Morgan and Rockefeller, but Koch, Allison, and Walton. Thank you, Tim Kelly, for coming and doing the interview. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Very much enjoyed it.
Trials and crosses, everybody equal, get social and the title, everybody jump on socialism train, everybody jump on socialism train, everybody jump.
Women, War, and WikiLeaks, Saturday afternoon at 2:30.
Are you a woman? Do you know a woman? If so, please tune in to Shots in the Night Radio Theater Program Thursday, August 6th at 7:30 p.m. We'll see you there.
on the next Bioneers.
We expect by the year 2020 to operate our petro-intensive company in such a way as to take from the earth only that which the earth can renew rapidly and naturally, not another fresh drop of oil, and to do no harm to the biosphere. Zero footprint by 2020, mission zero.
Friday, 9:30 a.m.
Hi, this is Jacob White. The university is one of the oldest workplaces in the world and is known for having some very old traditions and mores, such as the robes people wear at graduation. Academe is also known for having some unique employment traditions, such as tenure and academic freedom, that have come up for debate between professors who teach classes and the administration who are responsible for the maintenance and supervision of the institution and separate from the faculty or academics. Joining us today on Heartland Labor Forum is Ron Barrett Gonzalez, a professor of aerospace engineering at KU, who serves as president pro tem of the KU chapter of the American Association of University Professors. Hi, Ron.
Yeah, hi, Jake. It's good to be here. I appreciate the invite.
Thank you. So you recently co-wrote a letter to the editor in the Lawrence Journal World titled Not Faculty. And in this editorial, you write about how an employee of KU who is not a member of the faculty, but is rather an administrator. One key way you make a distinction between the two roles is by noting that he has been at the university for more than 7 years without going through a tenure process. Can you tell us a bit more about this case and why the distinction between faculty and administration is so important?
Sure. No, I appreciate that. That's a very good question. So, and in any institution of higher learning, there will be a certain vetting process that individuals have to go through. And the vetting process for most faculty is extensive. And that includes interviews and close examination by learned colleagues of the resumes. The big objection that we have in this particular case is that the individual in question has not been properly vetted by the faculty. And so he was appointed primarily for administrative duties and then research, which is fine. We need administrators and we need skilled administrators as well. But he wound up in the classroom. And so we have somebody who has not gone through all the hoops and hurdles to be properly checked out by his colleagues. He's part of no department either. And so you can't actually go to the department and say, oh, in this department you have this person who has not been vetted by you guys. Can you check his resume? That doesn't even exist. So we have a very, very small number of people at the University of Kansas who are on shaky grounds as far as faculty. And we consider in this particular one case this individual primarily to be an administrator. Now, the concept of tenure is sort of the byproduct of a trial period. So you get 7 years of instruction on your way to tenure. At the end of those 7 years, your colleagues will evaluate you and they'll say, oh, this person is good at teaching and or scholarly endeavors like research and service. And if they pass muster, then there'll be a committee of faculty members at several levels in the department, the school, and the college, and the university, and they say, oh, this is a person we want to keep, or this is not a person we want to keep, and they do not get tenure. Once you do have the rank of tenure, it's basically an indefinite appointment that is terminable only by cause. And so within the state of Kansas, we have a process called post-tenure review. And this individual in particular hasn't been vetted. He hasn't been gone through the tenure process, and he's not subject to post-tenure review. And we believe it's fundamentally inappropriate to put him in the classroom because he hadn't been vetted. Doesn't mean he's doing a bad job. It just means he has been checked.
Mm-hmm. And he also has been testifying in Topeka as a member of the faculty, supposedly.
Yeah, and that is especially worrisome as well. We will note that a lot of his thoughts and scholarly endeavors have been absorbed by the party that's currently in power in Topeka, and many will argue we're directly responsible in great part for the debacle that we've had with the Kansas budgets. So they adopt these policies where basically you get rid of all the taxes, and then somehow magically businesses will flood into Kansas and everything will be great. And unfortunately, that hasn't simply worked out. It turns out that the scholarship of the individual involved, because he was hired on basically one in four functions, were to produce scholarly papers. He has not published a single scholarly paper in an internationally peer-reviewed journal. That is very worrisome as a faculty member. Most of us really, really work hard. We are experts in our area. We are published many, many times over. Our papers and our work are reviewed by peers around the world, literally from Singapore to Stockholm to Shanghai. They all look at our work and they say, oh, yes, this is good, or no, you need to change that. To have an individual who counts himself among the ranks of faculty when he's really not, advise Topeka on these kinds of matters, and then decision makers in Topeka swing an entire government's budget on his words is very, very troublesome.
And academics work really hard just to produce two or three publications a year, three if it's like a great year. So the fact that he hasn't produced any really shows how he's more of an administrator than a professor.
Yeah, you could make that argument, absolutely. You know, it normally even a thoughtful and numerically low performing faculty member, somebody who takes their time to produce a journal article, which is fine, you can take your time. But they'll produce at least one, but to be in place for more than a decade and to have your colleagues around the world examine your work and not approve a single paper, that kind of means that you're sort of out there on the fringe. You're not necessarily in the mainstream of economic thought or budgetary matters or governance. So that was the crux of what gave me and Professor El Hodiri, Muhammad El Hodiri of the University of Kansas, great pause, along with our entire chapter. We see this as a corruption of the academic enterprise, and we are especially worried that he is helping mold young minds without being vetted. It doesn't mean that he's doing a bad job. It doesn't mean that he's teaching inappropriate things. It doesn't mean that any individual is doing that. It just means that he hasn't been checked out. Imagine somebody that drives the streets of Kansas City without being checked out whether or not their eyesight is good or they've actually passed driver's license check. That's kind of what we've got. We've got sort of an unlicensed driver running around on our campus. Not good.
And on the other side of the tenure equation from him, who really is almost exempt from the sort of publisher perish mentality that can be part of academia, is people who don't have tenure, and they're really lacking a critical workplace protection. So could you tell us more about the adjuncts in
sure.
the AUP? And
yeah, absolutely. So, you know, the mark of tenure, again, it's tenure is an indefinite appointment. Where an individual can only be fired for cause. Individuals who can be fired without cause are an individual, say, who works at Acme Burger, and the manager simply sees a downturn in business and says, I'm sorry, Joe, but I don't need you next week, and I think we're done with you for the year. That's being fired, terminated without cause. An academician has to be fired for cause if they're dismissed, if they're tenured. And what that means is that there's an extensive process that the institution has to go through, and typically a jury of their peers must agree that the individual has been derelict in their duties or has behaved inappropriately. And very infrequently, but from time to time, that does happen. There are mechanisms to relieve tenured faculty members of their jobs, and it happens around the state. KU Med Center had one. The K-State had another. Benedictine had another. So there are cases all around the state. If there are faculty members who have taught for some time in a non-tenure track position, There is typically a seven-year period of trial period. So if you wanted to teach at a university, if you are hired full-time for teaching and or research for 7 years, that is the trial period time by which at the end of it, you will be granted either de jure or de facto tenure. And it means that the institution at that point on has checked you out and you can only be terminated for cause.
Mm-hmm. And we've seen a attack on tenure in the K through 12 section of the Kansas educational system. And how has that impacted the university level?
Yeah, so this is, you know, and I must stress that that for me to comment on that, I'm not speaking as an officer of the University of Kansas or even an AAUP member, because that's not our area, but me personally, myself and a number of other faculty members, we've seen an incremental decline in the quality of our students. And we've also seen another bizarre trait. We've seen a number of students who have been entering at an ever more rapid rate who feel free to engage in academic misconduct or cheat. And last year we had an explosion with an entire class in the School of Engineering was caught cheating, and the instructor chose to do nothing about it because he didn't have tenure. He had no tenure perfections. And that was very unfortunate because he knew that his teaching evaluations would be destroyed. We see a similar dynamic in the K through 12 system, that one of the easiest ways to be dismissed is to anger parents. And there nothing makes parents more angry than for their little Johnny or Sally to be accused of academic misconduct. And they'll lobby to have that individual teacher dismissed. So we see a very unfortunate dynamic that we believe is taking hold in the state of Kansas.
How does a very old institution such as the Academy deal with a very new form of communication like social media? Has KU come to any resolutions lately, and can you tell us about the history of this issue a little bit at KU in the last couple minutes we have?
Sure. So this no doubt alludes to like the social media policy and things like that, and the rank-and-file faculty and certainly the AAUP rail against the Kansas Board of Regents' social media policy, whereby a faculty member or many students who are employed by the university and staff members can be dismissed for disrupting the harmony of the workplace. It is, in great part, our job to shake society up. We're supposed to find things that other people don't see or don't know. And we're supposed to bring new ideas to the fore. And in many ways, I would argue that if we are not disrupting the harmony of society in general and making people think, we're not doing our jobs. So the social media policies that have come down from the Board of Regents, we see as wholly counter to our mission in higher education. It has damaged all of the Regents' institutions, and it has in many ways made the institutions of the state of Kansas a laughingstock around the country.
As an engineer, you have the option, if you wanted, to go into industry if you ever got too upset with what was happening in Topeka or with the administration. So I guess, have you ever thought about what a red line would be, or why, or have you noticed a trend of people going to industry instead of going to academia?
Yeah, there's a non-trivial number of people who go into industry, but most of the people who wind up in academia do so because they love to be around like-minded young people who inspire them. And so what has happened is we've seen a flight of faculty, not necessarily from the University of Kansas and other institutions, but to other institutions across the country who do respect the right to freedom of speech and don't have moronic social media policies.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us today, Professor Barrett.
It's my pleasure.
Professor Barrett is the president pro tem of the KU chapter of the AAUP, American Association University of University Professors, yes. And he is joining us today on the Heartland Labor Forum. You're listening to the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Jacob White. Thank you.
This is Mary Aria for Safety First. First, senior U.S. health officials kill proposal to curb mercury dental fillings. From July 21st, Kansas City Star. The proposal, approved by the top Food and Drug Administration officials in late 2011 and kept secret since, would have told dentists they should not use mercury fillings in cavities in pregnant women, nursing moms, children under six, and people with mercury allergies, kidney diseases, or neurological problems. It also urged dentists to avoid using fillings that contain mercury compound in any patient where possible. The proposal and its rejection after a cost-benefit analysis by officials at the Department of Health and Human Services put the Obama administration in an awkward position of concealing for over 3 years a safety communication potentially affecting millions of Americans. The safety communication was drafted in response to citizen petitions and an FDA advisory panel of outside experts. The first public hint that the agency might shift its position came during a town hall meeting in September 2011 in San Francisco, where the director of the FDA Center for Devices and Radiological Health heard from several dental patients. They described recovering from severe health problems after having mercury fillings removed. Sometime later, the Department of Health and Human Services quietly killed the FDA's communication. Department officials concluded that the out-of-pocket costs of patients with dental insurance coverage would triple if they had to pay for alternative fillings, imposing an unfair burden on low-income Americans who might then neglect decaying teeth. An American Dental Association survey in 2009 indicated 54% of U.S. dentists used mercury fillings. However, the number of dentists abandoning those products has risen steadily over the past 20 years as concerns have mounted and alternatives have improved. Mercury compounds have been used to fill cavities worldwide for more than 160 years, but the Food and Drug Administration never required clinical testing to prove their safety. Their use was permitted under a grandfather clause after the agency was created in 1930. What the Star article doesn't mention is the occupational side of the story. A recent independent documentary, shown at the Kansas City Film Fest last April 18th and 19th, exposes the occupational hazards of mercury to dental professionals doing routine dental work. You Put What in My Mouth?, directed by Kansas City resident Randall Moore, follows the lives of three health advocates as they struggle to inform the federal government and public that vast amounts of mercury vapor and particulate matter are being released during working with and the removal of silver mercury amalgam dental fillings. The film is scheduled for wider release in October. For more information, go to www.youputwhatinmymouth.com. Finally, local company and consultants go out of their way to obstruct OSHA inspection. From the pump handle at scienceblogs.com/thepumphandle for July 16th and OSHAregulationsblog.com for July 31st. In what is believed to be the first time in federal OSHA's history, a company has been found in criminal contempt for not allowing OSHA to inspect a facility after a judge's order. Now a federal court has fined four people. Martin Foundry, Inc. owner Daryl Stone and three representatives from Compliance Professionals, Inc., a safety consulting company, all based in Kansas City, Missouri, have been fined for disobeying an administrative search warrant issued by a judge to cooperate with an OSHA inspection. Stone and the three consultants must jointly pay almost $11,000 to reimburse OSHA costs based on a finding that they willfully impeded OSHA's investigation and refused to comply with the warrant. OSHA attempted to inspect the foundry March 27th after the Missouri Department of Health reported that an employee had elevated blood lead levels. Stone refused to allow inspectors into the foundry. OSHA obtained a warrant and returned April 7th. Stone and the consultants again refused to allow them in. The inspectors returned later that day with U.S. Marshals. According to OSHA, Martin Foundry and compliance professionals persisted in obstructing OSHA's investigators after the U.S. Marshals left the workplace. OSHA was only able to complete the inspection after the U.S. Department of Labor and Justice attorneys initiated contempt proceedings. The results of the inspection are pending. This is Mary Aria for Safety First.
And this is the Heartland Labor Forum calendar for August 6, 2015. Canvassing to sustain right to work veto, Wednesday evenings and Saturday until mid-September veto session. To sign up And for locations, call Kansas City Jobs with Justice at 816-753-0689. Try listening for a change. Ira Harrod and Mary Hyatke talk about Move the Money Listening Project at the Empower Missouri First Friday Forum, Friday, August 7th, 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. That's at the Westport Flea Market Bar and Grill, 817 Westport Road. Coalition of Black Trade Unionists Mass Incarceration Training, Saturday, August 8th, 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. UAW Local 249, that's at 8040 Northeast 69th Highway, Pleasant Valley, Missouri, 64068. Part of the AFL-CIO's Common Sense Economics to understand the policies which ensure the economy doesn't work for working people. Women's equality work. It's still coming up. August 23rd to the 30th. Many events. For flyer, go to Women's Equality GKC on Facebook. And check out the Heartland Labor Forum schedule on www.heartlandlaborforum.org, where you can listen to today's show. And like us on Facebook. And if you have any ideas, call 816-235-1470.
Thank you so much, Molly, for that. And tune in next week. We are going to have a segment called Bullies in the Workplace. And I have been your engineer tonight and host, Jen Zaman.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. We are sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Our volunteers come from a wide variety of workplaces and unions. We are supported by many Kansas City area unions and the AFL-CIO. To talk back to us, to volunteer, or to let us know about news or events, call us at 816-235-1470 or go to www.heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here on 90.1 FM KKFI.